So last time we defined MOS forms. So last time we defined MOS forms, and gave a very simple example of a MOS form, namely the Eisenstein series. The full modular group. Gamma S half so and so this was the simplest example of a MOS form. And we derived a Fourier expansion for it. And the Fourier expansion is given by the following expression. So first, let me make the remark that this can be written in some sort of easier expression, which allows us to think of it. The automorphy of the function is transparent if I write it in this fashion, where gamma infinity is a stabilizer and gamma is SL2z in this case. And so it's clear that EZS is capital gamma invariant. And so the Fourier expansion Fourier expansion was derived last time as follows. So plus, there are more terms, of course, R not 0, R to the S minus a half, sigma of 1 minus 2S, R root Y, K Bessel function, and E to the 2 pi I mod X, where the notation sigma of nu of n is just simply the sum of the dth, sum of the nth powers of the divisors d of n, and k sub s is the k Bessel function given by this is what we derived last time. And a simple exercise shows that k sub minus s of y is k sub s of y, and that the divisor function equally has a reflection property, and from that we deduce the functional equation of the series. Okay. Now, it's amazing that I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that this calculation lies at the heart of the Langlands program. I mean, the calculation of the Fourier expansion, and most notably the calculation of the constant term, lies at the whole thrust of the Langlands program. The most important feature here to observe is that the zeta function appears as the constant term, and that's the general theme in the whole program, that automorphic L functions appear as constant terms of Eisenstein series. Now, as a possible introduction to later developments, I'd like to indicate how this simple derivation can be used to show that the zeta function doesn't vanish on the line real part s equals 1. The advantage of this little exercise that I'll do is twofold. Firstly, it is basically the calculation that was extended by Jacquet and Schleicher to show that the automorphic L functions don't vanish on the line real part s equals 1. And secondly, the advantage to this calculation is that the non-vanishing theorem doesn't use the use of Euler products. So in the classical proof, you know, the Hadamard de la Vallée-Poussin's proof, you use the fact that you have an Euler product in your possession, and in this case you don't use that fact. So let me kind of give you this derivation. So suppose that zeta of 1 plus I t naught equals 0, then the thing to observe is that if I plug in s equals a half 1 plus I t naught over 2, then I get zeta 1 plus I t naught here and zeta 1 minus I t naught here, and they will both disappear. So you end up getting a Maas cusp form for the specialized specialization. So suppose that this happens, put s equals 1 plus I t naught over 2 in the Eisenstein series, then the constant term vanishes, and we get a Maas cusp form. Okay, so let's write it down. And do a little bit of simplification. If you combine the terms r equals the positive r and the negative r that occurs in this formation, and combine the things together, you'll see that this can be rewritten as 4 root y, summation r going from 1 to infinity, r to the s minus a half, sigma of 1 minus 2s, r cosine 2 pi r x times this integral 0 to infinity, e to the minus pi r y t plus t inverse dt. T plus T inverse, yeah, that's okay. T plus T inverse dt over t to the power 1 plus I t naught divided by 2. That's okay. Okay. Now, it's rather easy to estimate these integrals. For one thing, the integral is exponential decay. Since r is going from 1 to infinity, it's not hard to see that this whole thing is O of e to the minus constant y. And so this is indeed a cusp form. And so we can try and estimate, try and use the fact that since this is a cusp form, the constant term in the Fourier expansion of this particular cusp form is going to be 0. So in particular, this is of exponential decay. And so if we compute the constant term of the Fourier expansion of this Maas form, then we should get 0. So let's do that.
So well, that's the constant.
I mean, Z is equal to, of course, X plus IY. So this is equal to 0. And if we multiply this equation by y to s minus 2, and integrate from 0 to infinity, we get that 0 equals the integral from 0 to infinity, 0 to 1, e of x plus iy, 1 plus I t naught, 2 y to the s minus 2, dx dy. Okay, now remember that when gamma is s go to z, stabilizer at infinity consists of all these matrices of the form 1 and 0, 1. And the fundamental domain, so the upper half plane, modulo the action of gamma infinity, is just simply equal to the minus a half to a half this region. And of course this region can be written as a union of the standard fundamental domain like so, and therefore we can rewrite I've shifted, you know, I had minus half to a half, but that's the same as from 0 to 1. So this region that we're integrating over can be expressed as a union of the translate of the standard fundamental domain. So we may write the integral from 0 to infinity, the integral from 0 to 1, whatever dx, dy, y squared, whatever it is, as a summation whatever it is, dx, dy, y squared. So we just have this property. Okay, so we have this, and so let's write this down. 0, therefore, equals summation gamma in gamma mod gamma infinity and y is the imaginary part of z. Now we'll change variables and shift the gamma into here, and since EZS is gamma invariant, this stays the same, but this will become gamma ZS. So we can write this as 0 equals, and then move the summation inside, and then use the fact that one could write the Eisenstein series in this fashion. We get that I think I've run into notational trouble. Let me just put, if I multiply by pi to the minus s gamma s 1 half, I still, with the special, with an arbitrary s, it's still okay. So we still have that 0 this is a gamma invariant measure, therefore this comes out like this, and it's valid for all S in the complex domain. Okay. Yeah, so let's assume real part S bigger than 1. Pardon me? Oh, yeah. Especially when you have cusp forms, exponential decay. Yeah. Now, the same thing is now true because EZ 1 plus IT naught over 2 is a cusp form and it's exponential decay. I can now put any S in C. Okay? That's important. So in particular, we will choose basically 1 minus IT naught over 2. So choose, now observing that EZS bar is the same as EZS bar, we get identically zero. This is equal to zero, and this is means that the integrand must be zero. So here's a MOS form which is identically zero. Now the question, the point is now, is this actually identically zero? We have a Fourier expansion for these MOS forms, so all you have to do is compute a Fourier coefficient and show it's not zero. And you get a contradiction. That's what we'll do. Well, I won't do all the details, but more or less that's the idea.
Yeah. That's the usual eigenfunction
in
language change method.
Right.
And that one is holomorphic at real S equals 1/2.
Right.
Kind of symmetry.
Right.
And then if your delta function is 0, then you get contradiction.
Exactly.
That's how you usually drive the
non-vanishing. Yeah.
I guess, but this is kind of a...
Yeah, but for that I need that theorem that EZS is analytic on the line real part S equals a half.
You are driving that.
I'm deriving that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's the other way around.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, yeah. But it has to be proved at some point.
I mean, that's Langlands, side of the Langlands show.
Yeah.
The eigenstate divided by delta 2 S is holomorphic, the kind of symmetry.
Yeah.
And you are driving that.
I'm driving that. Yeah.
Okay.
I think you have to prove something somewhere. Even in the analytic continuation of the Eisenstein series, I think the non-trivial part, I mean, enters at the crucial step. I mean, it's non-vanishing. Okay. It's a question of normalization, I think. Yeah. Okay. Now, I did rub this off, but fortunately, I've got the Fourier expansion up there, right, in the middle of the board. And all we have to do is check that one of the terms is not zero. So that's a Fourier expansion. So So we just need to check.
So to show non-vanishing,
that the integral 0 to infinity e to the minus pi r y t plus t inverse dt over t to the 1 plus I t naught is not 0. Now, the fastest way of showing this is by putting t equal to e to the theta and applying the saddle point method, a simple theorem from calculus. So basically you end up dealing with the integral minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus pi r y, e to the theta plus e to the minus theta, minus e to the t theta, not 0. So this is the question for some r. And it boils down to checking the following thing, which I will leave the details for you to verify. This is T0, thanks, yeah. Okay, so it boils down to determining the asymptotic behavior of the integral e to the minus y, a to the theta plus a to the minus theta after a few changes of variables, cos theta, d theta. The question is, for an a bigger than 1, what is the behavior of such a integral? Well, recall from calculus that we have the saddle point method of Laplace, tells us that the behavior of integrals subject to suitable conditions, if I have an integral of the form of that shape, then this is asymptotic to g of 0 square root pi over 2x f double prime of 0 as x goes to infinity, provided that f and g, f has two continuous derivatives. And g is continuous with f of 0, f prime of 0 equal to 0, and f double prime of 0 is positive. And that's it. So you take this little result from calculus. Actually, you don't even need to invoke this. You could do this directly without using anything. I mean, more or less write down the Taylor expansion of the function inside the integral and just do the integration. And when you plug it back in here into the situation that we need to look at, you end up getting that that the integral 0 to infinity e to the minus x, a to the theta plus a to the minus theta minus 2. That's the way I have it here. So cos theta d theta is asymptotic to e to the minus 2x pi x. 2 log a. Okay, so from this calculation, it's easy to see that this is not zero.
That's it. More or less, does it?
Okay, so that gives a proof of the non-vanishing. And apparently, if I understand things correctly, one of Sarnak's students has pushed this method together, zero free region for the zeta function, which is not as good as the Hadamard de la Vallée-Poisson region, but good enough that you could push this method for higher groups, higher level groups. Pardon me? Oh, you're the one that's working on it. Oh.
So what? He'll give a talk.
Oh, you'll give a talk. Okay. So what is the status of the?
Well, that part, the is that the asymptotics of whatever function is going to the zero free region, but it hasn't been done yet.
Oh, okay. But you, what is it right to
Sorry,
say that? Okay. But you don't get the classical region, but you get something slightly worse. Yeah. Okay. In 3 weeks, okay, all right. So good advertisement. Now it's interesting that if there's a historian in the room, I'd like to know, was Moss a student of Hecke? Is that true?
Actually, if you look in the back of Hecke's collected work, with all of his students.
Yeah, I'm kind of guessing that he was, because Moss worked out the you know, if you take a zeta function of an imaginary quadratic field and you do the automorphic induction with a modular form of CM type, and I think he gave this problem for the real quadratic case to his student, and that's how Moss forms were more or less discovered. This is my, but I don't have any history source to. So since there's no vehement disagreement, so I think we can say that. So I think this is Moss's first example of a Moss form. You take a quadratic field, be a real quadratic field, and let psi be a Hecke character. So a Hecke character can be factored as a finite Hecke character in an infinite part, a real quadratic field, and taking it over Q of that shape. And we will assume that F has narrow class number 1. So the narrow class group is you usually have an equivalence relation on the ideal classes, that two ideal classes are equivalent. I mean, you take the group of ideal classes and then mod out by principal ideals. But if you insist that the generator is totally positive, you get the notion of a narrow ideal class group. Okay. So it certainly has larger order. And in that case, we write down, let nu1 and nu2 be as follows. I don't like this notation, epsilon1, epsilon2, because it confuses you with units. But anyway, with and epsilon I equal to 0 or 1, okay, then psi infinity of x is just going to be the sine of x1 to the epsilon 1, sine x2 to the epsilon 2, um, actually I don't need the new one to new. So let's just pick just any old new. I mean, I'm specializing the general case to the quadratic case, and I don't think I need to say anything about that. So just do that. Where x1 and x2 are the conjugates of x. I mean, just so one of them is going to be x itself, and the other one's the quadratic conjugate, the Galois conjugate. So you have this. And then it is necessary to assume that for all units of the field, psi infinity is 1, so that you have a Hecke character on your hands. Equal to 1 for all invertible, for all the units. So that means, i.e., it boils down to saying that if I take the norm of eta to the 2 new power, that turns out to be 1. And this condition forces, this implies, that nu is equal to some integer m times I pi over 2 log eta 0, where eta 0 is a fundamental unit, is the fundamental unit, because I want it to be positive. Now, let's write theta sub psi of z to be a summation over all integral ideals of the ring of integers of k, psi of a, root y, k sub nu, 2 pi, norm of a, y, cosine 2 pi, norm of A, X. Yeah, it's okay. If epsilon is 0, if actually epsilon is equal to epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. See, as I said, I was taking the general case and specializing it to a quadratic field. If epsilon 1 equals epsilon 2 equals 0, and the same series with the sine instead of cosine, and the summation is over all integral ideals in here, then what Moss shows is that these two are actually cusp forms, real analytic cusp forms, and with the corresponding eigenvalue given by a quarter plus m squared pi squared over 4 log eta naught squared. So Moss proves that real analytic cusp form on gamma naught of D, where D is where D is such that F is equal to Q root D. And the eigenvalue is equal to a quarter plus m squared pi squared over 4 log eta 0 squared. Okay, so this is the first, perhaps the first non-trivial example. I mean, the trivial kind of case is the Eisenstein series case, but those are not cusp forms. They're Mas forms, but they have non-constant, non-vanishing constant term. And these are genuine cusp forms in the sense of the definitions that we've given, and those are the corresponding eigenvalues. I think there's a conjecture that, well, it's actually hard to construct Mas cusp forms, although Weyl's law tells you that there are lots of them around. Explicit constructions will only come from some form of, you know, automorphic induction and things like that. There's a general conjecture about the Fourier coefficients of Theca eigenforms, which are Mas cusp forms, and that is that if the eigenvalue is not equal to a quarter, I think the general belief is that the coefficients are transcendental numbers, kind of things that we're getting into here. Now, this particular example is a good illustration and motivation for the following definition. It's the most basic instance of automorphic induction, so maybe I should tell you a little bit of what that is. That they exist. That's right, yeah. So, explicitly, yeah. Okay. So here's the, I'm going to use notation which was introduced in the other two lectures. Basically, if let F be a field now, well, an algebraic number field, although it's not necessary, but I'll feel safe with that. And let A of, let's do it like this, A of F, A sub N of F, be space of cuspidal automorphic, let's put a circle there, representations of GLN of the Abel ring of F. And suppose I have a field K of degree D, then for each pi in, let me use capital pi. For each capital pi in A sub n 0 of f, we have, as was defined in Jim Cogdell's talks and Henry Kim's talks, we have the L function for each, corresponding to each place p. Well, maybe just use this notation, L as pi p, which was given in terms of the local Satake parameters, 1 minus, well, various Euler products, alpha p1 over norm p to the s. There is no product here. The global L function, of course, is defined as product of all the places. So the functoriality, one of the functoriality conjectures predicts that there's a map from the space of CUS forms of GLM AF to K corresponding to GLM D, where D is the degree of the field over the field K, with the property so that if I have a capital pi here, it gets sent to little pi here, and the local Euler factor corresponding to German P, which is a prime ideal of little k, would be all the prime, it's a product of all the local factors with script P dividing German P. So this is called the conjecture of automorphic induction. So this conjecture has been proved in the simplest case when F over K is Galois cyclic, so cyclic Galois extension. And this is the theorem of Arthur and Cosell. And that construction over there is a special case, a super special case of this phenomenon, where you are taking the Hecke L function upstairs in the quadratic field F and matching the Euler factors over for the prime downstairs, and then saying that the object that you, when you view it as an object over GLN, GL2 of the Adel ring of the rational numbers, you get something which is automorphic, but it's real analytic. So that's the special case of that phenomenon. There is a dual functor, which I maybe shouldn't say anything about, but a dual functor for this thing is, you should have a map going from here, automorphic forms of GLM AK to the automorphic, and this map is called the base change functor. So usually one should learn these things more or less at the same time. And this functor also exists, and that's a theorem of Arthur and Cosell as well, in the case that F over K is cyclic. If F over K is cyclic, the Euler factor that corresponds upstairs can be described easily as just the twists by the Galois characters of the extension. Okay, now I want to devote a little bit of time, as I promised last time, to describing the Rankine-Selberg method in the classical case. And then indicate applications of this thing to getting oscillation theorems for the Fourier coefficients of modular forms. So let F be a function on the upper half plane, which is gamma invariant. And of rapid decay. Which means that basically, if I think of it as a function of y, now the constant term, so because it's gamma invariant, And I'm assuming that, let's say gamma is SL2Z for a moment, or the matrix 1, 1, 0, 1 is in the thing, then the constant term is just obtained by integrating 0 to 1 of fx plus iy dx. Rather. Now, I would like to look at the constant term and define an L function attached to F as the Mellon transform of the constant term. Y to the S dy over y, y squared, let's put. Okay, so this is the L function that will attach to F. The question is, I'd like to obtain an analytic continuation and a functional equation for this L function. So we do that. We'll proceed like we did in the case of trying to show the non-vanishing result for the Eisenstein series. So again, the obvious thing to do is to write the L function as the integral from 0 to infinity, 0 to 1 of fx plus iy, yvs, dx, dy, by y squared. And it's pretty clear what to do because, as before, the fundamental domain of gamma mod gamma infinity, which of course I can always shift, but anyway, for symmetry reasons, I'll right, like this, is a union over all coset representatives of this style. Therefore, LFS can be rewritten as before, the sum over the coset representatives of gamma infinity over the translates of the fundamental domain let me put f of z here and now you can see the calculation is similar to the one I was doing earlier f is gamma invariant I started off with something like that before we had the Eisenstein series here y to the s I'm going to replace by imaginary part of y, z to the s, and then change variables, obviously. And then we end up getting that this is equal to as before. Plugging in the summation over the various coset representatives and interchanging summation, and I'm doing the same thing as before. So, as before. And this is the most, I mean, yes, I do. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. So we do this up to this point. It's okay. Right. So multiplying the left hand side by the various gamma factors and the zeta factors, etc. You multiply both sides by pi to the minus s gamma s theta 2s, and interchange summations to get, let's call this the extended L function or the completed L function, will then be the integral over the fundamental domain of f of z ezs dx dy of y squared. So I do have a complete function because it comes out because the coset representatives have to have the coprimality condition. Yeah. So when you remove the coprimality, you get zeta 2s. Okay. So the most, I mean, I find this always fascinating. The most impressive piece of the calculation is this property here, which translates this integral into an integral over the fundamental domain. And then because you have the analytic continuation of the Eisenstein series and the functional equation, you get the analytic continuation and functional equation of LFS for free. So the analytic continuation and functional equation of EZS gives us analytic continuation and functional equation of L star FS for free. So this is what's called the Rankine-Selberg method. If you can write down your automorphic function and integrate it against an Eisenstein series, you end up getting something which is an L series, which automatically has analytic continuation of a functional equation. This calculation appears for the first time in the 1939 PhD thesis of Rankine, which he wrote under G.H. Hardy. But he credits, believe it or not, he credits the idea to Ingham. So in the latest volumes of the Millennium Conference, I think that's where I read this, that he credits this idea to Ingham. Now, what you could do is you could take special cases of cusp forms, your favorite cusp forms, and check the constant term and obtain the analytic continuation of these things. Now, so let's look at a few examples. Simplest example is to take a classical cusp form . By the way, one more important feature of the method, no Euler products don't enter into this kind of calculation. This is I tried to point that out at the very beginning to show that the non-vanishing of the zeta function isn't using the Euler product. And here again, the Euler products are not entering. This is very general. Take a classical cusp form and look at this. So let's say this is our function f of z, then this is gamma invariant. So f is gamma invariant. That's just because the modularity of f, so if you plug in f of gamma z and do the calculation, this comes out to the same as f of z after you use the modularity of f. So this is gamma invariant. Rapid decay, it's a cusp form. Rapid decay, so it's okay. You stick it back in here, and the L function, so what is the constant term? Well, let's suppose the Fourier expansion is summation a sub n either 2 pi I n z, n going from 1 to infinity, then the constant term is just simply y to the k summation mod a n squared e to the minus 4 pi n y. That's the constant term. And so, what is the Mellin transform of this constant term? Because that's the L function that this is giving us the analytic continuation for free. So what is the L function? The L function, the completed L function, in this case, let's say it's, for simplifying matters, let's say it's of level 1. So let's say level 1. Then the L function turns out to be 4 pi to the minus s minus k minus 1 gamma of s plus k minus 1. Summation that. I might have lost a bunch of factors. Sorry, there are more things in here. Zeta 2s, of course, is always there, and gamma of s is there. There might be a pi to the minus s here, a 2 to the minus 2s here. I don't vouch for this, but anyway, more or less the shape of the Dirichlet series is essentially this. That's the point. Now notice that this Dirichlet series has non-negative coefficients, and therefore we can apply that theorem of lambda as generalized by Chandrasekhar and Narasimhan last time to derive the following estimate. So apply the theorem of Chandrasekhar and Narasimhan. To deduce that summation n less than x mod a n squared is equal to 3 over pi, this is the Peterson inner product, let's say it's weight k, classical form of weight k. Well, I put it in there, x to the k plus O of x to the k minus 2 over 5. So this, you get the analytic, by the way, important point is, remember that the Eisenstein series is a pole at s equals 1, and therefore, when I said analytic continuation, of course, there might be a pole, and the residue is the integral of f of z over the fundamental domain. And in this case, this is what you're integrating over the fundamental domain, which is the Peterson inner product. So that's non-vanishing, and therefore there is actually a pole there. So this particular formula was derived in Rankine's thesis, and he applied, of course, as I mentioned, the work of Chandrasekhar and Narasimhan is a work in the general L functions. But the method that Rankine applied is a classical method due to Landau. And this allows us to deduce that the Fourier coefficient itself is O of n to the k over 2 minus 1 over 5. So this was Rankin's contribution towards the Ramanujan conjecture. And in the case, now, if you were to take a weight zero mass form, so if you were to take a weight zero mass form and do this calculation, so that's the second example. Let f of z mod f of z squared, where f, where f is a weight zero mass form. Then the L function is essentially, again with these gamma factors which I'm just going to drop, the where the AMs are the Fourier coefficients of the mass form. And then when you apply the Rankin technique here, you end up getting that AN. This is the Rankin-Selberg method. Gives you O of n to the 3/10, 3 over 10. The reason I distinguish these two cases is because it is a theorem in the classical modular form case that you have the Ramanujan conjecture, so this, the result obtained by that method is weak. And until recently, maybe last 25 years or before that, this was the best. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, in both cases.
Oh yeah, and
both cases. Yeah. Both cases, yeah. A third example would be to take two cusp forms. Take F, G, two distinct cusp forms. Actually, for the method to work, you can just take one cusp form and one Eisenstein series or one non, you know. So, essentially, enough to have, which is an important idea if people are trying to study special values of L functions, you know, because when you take the Rankin-Selberg convolution of cusp form with an Eisenstein series, you end up getting products of the L function back. So, if you're interested in special values, this is ideal. So anyway, enough to have one cusp form for convergence purposes. And when you compute the, so let's say f of z is an 2 pi I. Of z. Well, I'm thinking of them as holomorphic things, but it's not essential to have them as holomorphic things. So, then the if you look at y to the k, let's this is again another point. Let's assume for the moment that they're both the same weight, then if you look at y to the k f of z g of z bar, this is again gamma invariant. This is again gamma invariant. You can compute the constant term just like classical calculus. So the constant term comes out like that, and so the Mellin transform of the constant term comes out to be equal to an bn bar. There might be some shifts like s plus k minus 1, but that's more or less it. Okay, let's be precise. S plus k minus 1, but I'm not precise here, so it doesn't really matter, I think. But that's the shape of the L function. You could take different weights. You could take different weight, and so two cusp forms of different weights. K1 and K2, then you would consider y to the K1 plus K2 over 2 f of z g of z bar. And then that would be gamma invariant. And then again, the same thing, the L function attached to this object would be essentially a and b and bar over nbs. And the other important point in all these examples is that, again, the Eisenstein series has a simple pole at s equals 1, and the residue is the integral of capital F over the fundamental domain. So that would mean that you're going to end up getting the inner product of F and G as the residue at s equals 1, and therefore if F and G are orthogonal, there is no pole. Okay. One more point that I'd like to draw your attention to is that the value of the Kronecker limit formula is essentially computing the constant term in the Laurent expansion of the Eisenstein series. So the limit as s goes to 1 EZS is where eta z is the classical Dedekind eta function. The advantage of this formula is that when f and g are orthogonal, there is no pole, and therefore you can calculate the value of the L function at the edge of the critical, at the critical point, using this particular formula, that is useful in many applications in the study of special values of L functions.
Yeah.
So are you going to set it up in general with G cross G and H kind of? embedded into G, or G embedded into H, or whatever. And then the rank and sub, the general.
We set up rank and sub
in the general GLM.
That's the forms on the GLM.
Yeah. All right, okay. Now going back to this, remember last time I was saying that that if you there's a parallel, there's a kind of like a conceptual parallel between Ramanujan and the Ramanujan conjecture and the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture, and therefore if you took a mass form and did the get the calculation here, you get basically slightly weaker result than Selberg got on the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. So, I don't have the numbers here, but I just want to point that out, that because the gamma factors will involve the eigenvalues from this result, and the fact that this is holomorphic and for real part s bigger than 1 allows you to get an estimate for the eigenvalue lambda as well. And that value of lambda is not 3 over 16, it's something worse. So 3 over 16 you really need to do, you know, the Clostermann sum stuff. Okay, now I wanted to talk about oscillations and set myself up for next time. So oscillations of Fourier coefficients. So the question is, let me motivate it from a classical point of view. Let tau of n be the Ramanujan function. And we know that tau of n is bounded by n to the 11 halves times the divisor function, d of n, so this is the divisor function. And it's an exercise in elementary number theory to show that d of n is bounded by exponential, I think it's 2, okay, epsilon, log n over log n. So one can show that. And therefore, this is the Dillon bound. So this is the maximal order of the divisor function. The divisor function can get as large as something like this. And therefore, this would imply that the tau function is O of n to the 11 halves exponential C log n over log n. For some C. So the question is this estimate sharp? Is it possible that maybe tau n is O of n to the theta with theta less than 11 over 2. Now that this possibility was ruled out by Rankin. So Rankin shows that lim inf tau n halves. Actually, he shows that well, let me just leave it like that. Talk about plus or minus oscillation. Just leave it like that for now. So this is what he shows. So the question of whether you can have an improvement on the limb is out of the question. But the question of whether this is the right thing that goes in here is interesting. No. This thing? I think it does. Actually, he uses Rankin's algorithm. So, yeah. So this is an application of Rankin's algorithm. Okay. Now, the question is whether or not that thing is hit. And so here we return to the question of the Sato-Tate conjecture. So if the Sato-Tate conjecture is true, that is, when I write tau of p as 2p to the 11 halves times cosine of theta p, and the angles theta p's are uniformly distributed in 0 to pi. Now I get my normalization wrong again. I think it's 0 to pi with respect to 2 over pi sine squared theta d theta. I think it's 0 to pi. 0 pi. Okay. So if it's uniformly distributed with respect to this measure, then this means that we could arrange the number of primes, p, up to x, such that the angle theta p lies in any given sector, alpha beta, is asymptotic to pi of x times the integral from alpha to beta of 2 over pi sine squared theta d theta. And this is what the Sato-Tate conjecture would predict. So we don't know that, but it's supposing we did. Now the cosine function is symmetric about the y-axis, and somewhere around here it has a value of a half. So if I could arrange for lots of these angles, theta p's, to really be close in this small hover around zero. So if I could arrange a positive density of primes to have the property that theta p is in a small interval around zero, then cosine of theta p is very close to one. And this whole thing, tau of p, would be very close to 2 times p to the 11 halves. So it's already giving you an indication of why this is true, because you have, it's coming very close to that. And then the other aspect is that if it's close to 2, then take all the primes. So I'm running out of space. But take all the primes that have the property that theta p lies very close to 0. So if we could arrange a positive proportion of primes to let's say with theta t to be, you know, minus delta with delta sufficiently small, then cos theta p is very close to 1, and then tau of p is more or less bigger than 2 minus epsilon p to the 11 halves. Okay, so for example, maybe if we can pick delta sufficiently small so that, let's say 2 minus epsilon is, well, this constant is bigger than 3 halves, let's say that would do it. So tau of p bigger than 3 halves, p to the 11 halves. So the Sato-Tait conjecture certainly predicts that, I didn't mean the last one, certainly predicts that this kind of thing would happen. And then we can take all these primes, p, up to x, with the property that theta p lies in this angle, in this sector rather, this interval. Take these, let me use capital N just for, and let's call this number p less than x. Let's call this capital N. Okay? Then what is tau N? Tau N is the product of the tau of p, because it's a square free number. And tau is multiplicative. And so the absolute value of tau N is the product of the absolute values. And each of these is bigger than 3 halves times p to the 11 halves. So this is bigger than or equal to 3 halves to the power, the number of such primes. And then p is the product of all the primes up to x with this property that's just n. So you get n to the 11 halves. So tau of n is bigger than n to the 11 halves times this particular factor. And so if we wanted to arrange that this particular factor is large, you just have to count how many primes there are. And when you do all that, since I'm running out of time, when you do all that, you end up getting, so, So I said that you would get a positive proportion of such primes. So the number of such primes is bigger than some delta naught x over log x. Okay. And so what's the relationship between x and this? Well, essentially, the product of these primes, so n is equal to exponential summation of the log p's, p less than x, theta p in this interval, and that's bigger than or equal to exponential delta naught x. So, let's bigger than or equal to that. So I don't need, that's right, okay. So take all the primes and just, AVX. Take all the primes and use Chebyshev's bound if you like. Thanks. So that means that X is bigger than or equal to some constant log N. And so we end up getting that tau n is bigger than or equal to exponential log of 3 halves, which is positive, the important point, times the number of such primes, which is delta naught times x over log x, and x we decided was bigger than log n, so x, you actually need a lower bound too, from the, well, in order to do the little thing here. That's true, yeah. So that gives me log n over log n. Something like that. So you end up getting this times n to the 11 halves. So the Sato-Tate conjecture would show that tau n divided by n to the 11 halves is very large infinitely often for these special n's that you construct. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to make the angles lie in certain sectors. So in order to get the angles to lie in certain sectors, you need to know something, at least some, well, do you need to know the full Sato-Tate conjecture is the question. And Rankin wrote a paper saying that if you had the full Sato-Tate conjecture, you have this, but next time I will show that if you have the holomorphy of the fourth symmetric power, it's enough to deduce this. Okay.